Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and how are you doing this week, Steve?
John, I am doing surprisingly well for 2020. How are you?
Surprisingly well. I love the anti-2020 memes. They're hilarious.
What's an anti-2020 meme? I don't think I've seen these.
Well, like the like your plans, and it shows like a rainbow and a unicorn, and then it shows 2020 and it shows like forest on fire and everything going wrong.
Oh God,
Like everything
yes.
good, like what you thought would happen in 2020 versus the reality.
All the potential and all the disappointment, yes.
Yes. One is one thing and the other is 2020 for sure.
Exactly.
But at least we have a president that's we figured out who it's going to be. So we have a Biden administration coming up, and that means some different regulations for fintech. I think they want to address financial inclusion. They're up for the digital assets. Some kind of direct account with the Fed. They want to look at testing to make access to banking services easier. Have you seen anything about this?
No, I have not. The only thing that I've heard really is the fact that under a Biden administration, we may have a more rational and more stable regulatory framework than we had under Trump, which I think is a net positive for all players in the ecosystem. But yeah, no, I haven't seen anything about the actual effects of Biden on fintech per se. So I'm quite curious to see what happens with this, next year or so when all the people are appointed and they're all in place and doing their job.
Yeah. It looks like they're still making a lot of appointments. The top level people are in, but there is a lot of emphasis on financial inclusion. So it'd be tougher on things like overdraft fees and late charges, things like that, make it tougher for people to keep a regular banking account, focusing on the underserved and unbanked. And they want to really help that. So fintechs are like, yeah, we'll do that. We've already been using up our VC money to not charge fees. So we'll be happy to do that. But on the other hand, the expectation is that there would be more regulation overall. So kind of like a good thing, bad thing
Right,
for the fintech side.
yes, it'll likely be more regulation, but more stable, more telegraphed regulation, which I think banks and players again sort of like that stability.
And if you're in line with what the administration goals are, then you're going to do better.
Right. And it's interesting because the markets have also responded quite well. I saw this morning that the Nasdaq hit a record today. And the Dow also rose 200 points today. So it seems like everyone's really bullish because of the vaccine, the more stable government. So 2021 could be a quite a good year to be in fintech.
All right. So it looks like everybody wants to be a bank these days. That's really been picking up lately. I've been seeing article after article about some fintech or some company wanting to be a bank. Actually, if you're listening, raise your hand if you're not trying to get a bank charter right now.
Exactly. It seems like everyone is. Yeah. This seems like one of those themes that could sort of carry throughout 2020. And I would argue even back into 2019. There's two really interesting plays here that happened. And they're not quite banks, I should say, but they're getting into the banking space. So the big one is Google Pay. Google Pay essentially now wants to become a holder of your money so that, the use case here is that I use Google Pay to just pay for stuff. I go to, my local Trader Joe's, buy my mochi ice cream, and I pay for it with my phone, and that withdraws the funds from my credit card. Now you can actually hold a balance in your Google Pay, sort of like you do with Venmo and PayPal. So Google has partnered with Citibank and other banks as well to offer this, and it seems like they're inching into the space. The big question is, why would Google want to do this? Care to take a guess as to what would be their objective in doing this sort of play?
To commoditize all banking services, crush banks under their heel while they become the major brand in banking.
Don't forget the data as well, right? They can also get your actual
Ah,
spend data.
I missed the thing right under my nose.
Yeah. I mean, imagine that you see an ad for, I don't know, L.L. Bean boots or something online, and then they see a few months later that you actually bought the boots. They can both attribute that purchase to that ad being displayed, maybe. Although they do claim, actually, I should know, so they do claim in the press release that payment data will not be used for ad targeting, which I think is highly dubious, honestly.
You're so funny, Steve.
I just don't see that happening.
Yeah, or else, what is their main motivation to get into the space otherwise?
Well, it's basically they say that it's kind of a cumbersome system. They like the idea of holding deposits. I don't think that they see this as a money-making play for them. It's just sort of getting you deeper into the Google ecosystem and then again getting access to your transaction data, which is super, super valuable. I know that all the companies, right, from Facebook, Google, and Amazon, the big three ad players, they all buy third-party payments data from MasterCard and Visa on, it's supposed to be very anonymized and so on and so forth. But I think that having direct access to that data will be amazing for them to see what people are spending money on, what are the trends, and that could really help them with their whole personalization, ad marketing, and all this stuff as well. So it's kind of a flywheel of stuff going on if they get into this space.
And they're just providing the front end. They don't have the bank charter. They're partnering with Citigroup, and then it's a lot of like smaller regional and community banks that have partnered with them so far.
Yeah, it's like First Bank of Seattle or something, some small hyper regional bank, and then Citibank doing also some of the deposits and holding the actual bank charter. So they're just sort of providing the interface and providing the Google Pay app so that you can move money around within the Citibank account.
Yeah, so it looks like, well, they're not the only one. I mean, Apple has been partnering with large banks and providing, now they're providing loans with the Apple Card and for their products. Facebook, of course, the Libra is going to be coming out next year, it looks like. Pretty soon we'll be running into one of the big techs for our banking services somehow.
We are, and that's actually, this gets us to the next story, which is Stripe. Stripe released something called Stripe Treasury as of this week as well, and it's a pretty interesting play as well. So as you know, Stripe allows you to accept payments online, and now they can also hold those funds for you, right? So if I sell, say, I don't know, Christmas cards online, and I get all the funds coming in, instead of withdrawing them to my banking account, my banking checking account, I can hold those on Stripe Treasury. And they can also use the funds there and the flows they see back and forth to make underwriting decisions as well. So again, kind of an interesting play to get into the enterprise side, but everyone's sort of inching towards becoming a bank and a lender and a treasury management provider as well.
I wonder if there'll be a drive at some point to make these interchangeable. Like you have money sitting in Venmo, money sitting in Stripe, with Google Pay, some kind of interconnection between all these guys.
They have, yeah, in the UK, that's basically the model is that you're able to pay from any account using their is it the open banking system? What do they call it?
Think the UK is the open banking one, right?
Yes, it is. Yeah. So basically, in the UK, you can pay from any account where you have money without having to actually use that service. So yeah, this kind of gets to the whole point of embedded finance and how essentially every player now, even if you're not a fintech company per se, can offer some sort of financing product or a financing solution for their customers. So yeah, it seems like everyone's encroaching upon the fintech and banking space.
Yeah, you had all these small companies just a few years ago, maybe 5, 6 years ago in their specialized space. And now it seems like they're growing into each other's space and overlapping a lot now.
They are, yeah. And it just seems like everyone's really focused on providing that working capital, providing the cash flow solutions and really getting to be the operating system for your company's finances.
And trust is a big factor for this. So, if you see like a familiar brand like Google or Apple, you already have that brand. You know they're not going to do anything overly sketchy, at least to your face, and you'll be able to get your money out. But that's not the case with some of these smaller players that don't necessarily have the financial backing, all the compliance, everything lined up in a row.
Great point. Just like Beam, right? Beam actually, were you aware of the whole Beam fiasco?
Not really. I think I just saw in the headline something about they had some problem, but that's it.
Yeah, so they were basically, one of these kind of very small fintechs, and they had accrued something like $2.5 million in deposits from 30,000 customers, basically. And the whole promise is that they would give you an APY or API, an APY higher than the industry average, so that you could actually earn interest on your deposits. But guess what? Nobody could get access to their money. So they ended up being sued by DOJ and I think the SEC as well. And the good news is that as of also this week, they claim that 98% of their affected customers were able to get their money back. But for several months, at least 4 months, people that had put in, you know, upwards of $15,000 in some cases could not get access through to their funds that they held in a Beam account.
So was this just some kind of operational issue? They had the money, they ended up giving it back. So what was the problem?
I don't know whether it was some sort of a shady practice or an operational issue. It doesn't bode well for the industry when we have these kind of rogue players doing this random things as well. And actually the same thing or a similar thing happened in the UK with a finance app that was released to, you know, to a lot of hype essentially. And they were called out by the FCU. Is that the, yeah, but anyway.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so they were called out by the FCU for basically operating without a license. I don't think this is the case with Beam per se, but it speaks to sort of the, you know, because this is such a hot space right now and everyone's trying to get into it as well. There's a lot of crazy Wild West kind of stuff going on. So you know, good news for Beam customers, but bad news that this kind of stuff and this lack of trust is still somewhat prevalent in the industry.
Yeah, you know, with so many fintechs and so many of these small operations, I'm actually surprised this doesn't happen more often.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. I'm surprised we don't hear some fintech going, you know, wired card level belly up on a weekly or monthly basis. There's just so many of them as well, right? It's just they propagate like freaking gremlins with water.
With water, that's right.
Yeah.
So Beam is pretty much done then.
I believe that's the case. I think there's still an ongoing concern, but they are being sued by the federal government, the FTC, and I think even the DOJ as well. So not doing so well.
And that's why I'm always paranoid about the compliance risk.
Which, you know, it makes sense. And it's also why whenever I get a new product, I always, you know, make sure that it's FDIC insured, like just make sure that everything's on the up and up. Because otherwise, despite the, you know, the nifty website and app, it could be kind of a shaky product from the fundamental side, right? It's just not a very well structured and liquid product. So buyer beware.
Hey, it's an initial coin offering. What could go wrong?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Nothing at all. Nothing at all.
And now it's time for our final bite, where we take a look at a number and the fascinating story behind it. You want to go first?
I do. My number is full of regret. So much regret.
Oh, man.
My number is $19,293. Any care to guess what that is?
Yes, I know that. It's $19,000. That's around the Bitcoin price these days.
It is indeed. It is the price of Bitcoin as we record this. And my regret is that I've always been a really vocal Bitcoin skeptic. And boy, do I regret that. No risk, no return. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I was just reading about a family that invested in Bitcoin back in 2008. They put all their savings, by the way, never a good strategy, but this time it paid off. They put all their savings into Bitcoin 12 years ago. And now, boom, they just live in like New Zealand or something half of the year. And half of the year somewhere else it's warm and beautiful. So they cashed out, they made out fine. Kids, don't do that at home, but I do regret not getting into Bitcoin earlier.
That is called concentration risk, putting all your eggs in one basket. There's even old sayings about it.
Yeah, you've got to diversify. So other than sort of the potential cratering of the economy, you know, with COVID back in March, April, what do you think is driving this surge in Bitcoin?
Oh, man, that's a tough question. I don't know what's going on with the whales these days, right? There's like a lot of concentration, a few big players, but
there is.
I guess it's a flight away from, well, actually the equity markets have been doing great too. Those are hitting records.
They are. They're
just putting money away. There is that kind of disconnect. Not kind of disconnect. There is definitely a disconnect between the fundamentals economy with the unemployment rate high and the markets, which have been going crazy. And so I've seen some discussion on that where it's kind of like the focus on the K-shaped recovery, like the top end is doing well, but those who are struggling are getting left behind. So I guess people who are still making money are investing it. And interest rates are so low, nobody wants to leave it in savings and not earn anything. They're taking a risk and putting it out there in the markets.
Yeah, I think there's also a lot of movement in this space, or signaling rather, from players like Square. I know that Square took a massive position on Bitcoin like two or 3 months ago or so, and that might have sort of legitimized the market or the commodity. But it's interesting. I couldn't pinpoint to one specific thing that made the price go up so much, but it seems like a confluence of factors, right? Square getting into it, the economy, the flight to more, to higher returns, that sort of made it a very attractive thing. I think it also has to do maybe with the fact that it's much easier now in 2020 to buy and trade Bitcoin than it was in 2008. Like, you don't need to be a computer whiz to do Bitcoin now. Now it's just a very easy interface. There's all these exchanges now that offer the services. So it's both easier, and there's a flight to that as well. That's my thesis anyway.
Confluence.
Confluence. Yeah, confluence and ease.
Yeah, I saw Square. They kind of jumped in relatively recently, but they've already making a good chunk of money from their cryptocurrency. They have a wide spread in what they buy and sell. They've
Yeah.
been doing really, really well with it.
Fortune favors the bold, my friend.
Yeah. So there's a lot more interest. And I guess all these day traders and people taking risks. We've talked about that
Robinhood.
with Robinhood, people jumping in, not knowing what the risks are, and sometimes you're lucky and sometimes you're not with that. But yeah, I think it's part of that wider trend of that.
I agree. Yeah. But anyway, that's my number, $19,293. What's your number, John?
Soon to be 50,000 is my prediction.
Don't tell me that. I should have bought
Do it.
Bitcoin 10 years ago. Oh well.
Hey, it's not a problem to take a risk on some of your money. Just don't throw it all in there.
Although I honestly, I think that rather than Bitcoin, I think that if I had a time machine, right, I think that I would go back and buy Amazon stock, not Bitcoin stock. Or Google stock or something, because that's, I think, more stable. And even
Yeah.
though we've seen some dips in the Amazon share price throughout the summer, I think that the pandemic will fundamentally change the way we shop. And Amazon is it's positioned, it's positioned to be a prime player, no pun intended, to take advantage of the new reality.
I think I would go. I'd have my parents buy Microsoft stock,
Right.
and then
During the Ballmer years.
just inherit that money. Yeah,
Yeah.
that's the two great ways to make money in America is steal it or inherit it. And the best way is to have your parents steal it and you inherit it,
Oh, that's win-win.
Kennedy style.
Win-win.
All right. Well, my final bite is 1%. That's not the top 1% or anything. It's the amount of consumers in the US that have used a buy now, pay later e-commerce service.
So
This is the
basically, fancy layaway.
fancy layaway, 21st century layaway. But you get to get the product right away, which is the good part of this. But it's not very big in the US yet. I mean, we see it in the news and the fintech press, but it's much larger in Germany and Australia, where about 20% of consumers have used a buy now, pay later service.
That is super high. What is the company that this that will go public this year? Affirm. Affirm is the
Affirm, yeah.
massive buy now, pay later player, right? There's
Affirm, there's
Klarna as well,
Afterpay, Klarna,
Afterpay. Yeah.
Splitit.
Yeah,
Yeah.
so many of these. So I've heard that actually this is good for consumers because it encourage well, it's good and bad. Apparently they tend to mostly approve purchases of things that are actually physical and that you'll see in your house, like a Peloton bike if you're Affirm or something. Whereas
Huh.
with credit cards, which you can use for, say, a meal or something that you'll forget 4 weeks later, you have less of an emotional connection to what you bought and therefore are less likely to pay back. So both Klarna, Affirm, and Afterpay, or all three of them rather, they claim to have very low default rates, much, much lower than what you see with credit cards, because again, of that connection that you have to the thing you bought. So you can't just use Klarna to buy, say, a burrito from whatever Taco Bell. You actually need to buy something physical with them, or like a couch or a bike or something like that. So it's interesting. On the other hand, I've also heard the discussions that by having all these, almost too easy to pay for products and services, you're encouraging a lot of consumerism and a lot of people just getting the debt for no reason whatsoever. So if you can't afford the thing you want to buy in all cash, then just don't buy it altogether.
Oh, Dad.
I know.
Yeah, well, there's some meals I've had that I wish I could pay on installments, actually.
That nice French laundry
But
trip.
yeah, boy, if you can get in there. What am I, the governor of California?
Or the mayor of San Francisco.
Or the mayor of San Francisco, right? They've gotten into trouble lately. But yeah, this is definitely a growing area, and you know, we kind of see these companies starting to pop up, but you know, the bigger players are jumping in as well. I just saw that JP Morgan Chase is moving into the buy now, pay later space as well. They have something called My Chase Plan for
Really?
their shareholders. Yep, and they can run from 3 to 18 months on those installment payments. So that's going to save you a lot of interest on something that if you were going to buy that anyway. Goldman Sachs has invested in some companies like this, MasterCard. PayPal is one of the big players now. PayPal is jumping into all the new things and doing well with them, apparently.
They sure are, yeah.
But it might not be as easy for these new players to keep expanding in the blue ocean strategy now that they've gotten attention, good valuations. Now the big guys are coming in to get some of that pie as well.
Yeah. That actually also raises a pretty interesting question, which is for me, you mentioned all the big players. Does this mean that we'll see a market that is heavily that it's heavily dominated by a couple of big players and that basically crowd out any other market entrants on the smaller side? Because it seems like it's all the massive fintechs, right? It's not the small ones really coming up and doing this kind of stuff.
That are jumping in. Well, these the Affirms and the Splitits are relatively small and new.
Well, small meaning, multi-billion-dollar valuations for all of them.
Yeah, but pretty recently. I mean, they've done really well just lately.
That's
But
true.
yeah, but everyone's jumping into the space now, so it's not going to be as easy anymore. It might be like, the way Chime might be crowding out the Challenger Bank space. You're not going to be able to jump in there and grow like they did as a late player, unless you're doing something very different or very, very well.
It's true, yeah. Speaking of Chime, a little side note here. It's really a bummer to see how Simple, which was again sort of touted as this Chime-like competitor, has really sort of fallen by the wayside recently, right? They were
That
acquired by
that's
the.
they're in very, very crowded company.
They are. I mean, if you offer a basically undifferentiated banking product, you're in deep, deep trouble, right? So they were acquired by BBVA, I think. A year ago or so, or a year and a half ago, maybe. And BBVA, of course, sold their US operations, including Simple, to PNC. And it seems like Simple wasn't even part of the transaction discussion. It was just like scraps in the deal. So poor Simple. We miss you. We wish you had succeeded as Chime has. But anyway, that's my little side note there.
Maybe they would have been fine jumping into the buy now, pay later space,
They might have been. Yeah.
along with everyone else these days. But yeah, the big guys are coming in. But yeah, this market is gonna grow. If it's anything like it's done in Germany and Australia, it's definitely gonna grow substantially in the US, and it's done better because of the pandemic and economic troubles, which encouraged this installment payments. And it's saving you interest if it's going to go on your credit card anyway, but it's going on months later, then that's a plus for you. So
Yeah.
let's see what happens. You should see a lot more in this space as those Australia. Is Klarna German, by the way?
I think they're Swedish.
Swedish. Yeah. As they start
Yeah.
to expand in the US. Actually, they've already, I just saw where they had 60,000 US stores that take Klarna already.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. That's
So,
a lot of stores.
and a lot of that is again fairly recent. So we're going to see that usage tick up as people become more aware of that in the U.S. And then those Gen Z and millennial, their parents and grandparents will say, "Yeah, that's just a layaway. I used to do
It's just
that at
a
Kmart
yeah, exactly.
ages
Yeah.
ago."
Yeah, actually, you know, I think it'd be great for a company like Klarna or Affirm to get into the Instagram space as well, because so many people buy stuff on Instagram because they have amazing ads, apparently. I don't use the service, but my wife does. And I think that if you could have a buy now, pay later thing on Instagram, that would be amazing as well, so that
I'm
you
sure
can.
a lot of them do because they are very online focused. They don't
It's
really
true.
do physical stores. That's not their focus anyway. But the popularity with merchants has been a big driver. They, you know, it's like I said, one easier way to get consumers to buy your product. So yep. they're happy to partner up, and that's why these companies have partnered with, you know, a lot of large retailers and a lot of locations.
Yep.
Because it's a win-win for the fintech and for the merchant.
It is,
and have to pay the fee, but it's probably a lot cheaper than a new customer acquisition cost and marketing to drive.
Right. Yes. I was going to mention actually that their model is that they charge the merchant, not the customer. So the merchant gets, you know, basically more stuff out the door, and the consumer gets an interest-free loan. So, you know, the merchant gets to increase their sales. The consumer gets to buy their stuff they want now without actually having to access their credit or pay for stuff now. And then Affirm gets, or Klarna get a small percentage of that transaction as well. Although in the case of Affirm, I've read that in their S1, they mentioned that Peloton is by far their biggest merchant on the platform. They account for something like 30% of it. Yes.
That's hilarious.
It's pretty funny. But again, it gets back to having that one massive purchase. But it presents some risks because you have one single merchant accounting for something like over a quarter of your volume.
Right. More concentration risk.
More concentration.
It all circles back.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. We'll keep watching the space. It's bound to be interesting and probably some new ideas. I wouldn't be surprised if there was some new variations on the product. All right. That's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in FinTech news. And thanks again for listening.
See you next week.